Hey guys, I want to welcome you to the Mosaic Podcast. I'm Pastor Erwin Raphael McManus, and just wanted to thank you for listening. In case you didn't know, I just released a new book. It's called The Genius of Jesus, The Man Who Changed Everything. And you can order it today at thegeniusofjesus.com.
Well, welcome to Mosaic. And I hope that you're exactly where you thought you're supposed to be. And that if you're a guest, we're so glad you're here. And maybe she didn't tell you, meet me at Mosaic, and you thought it was a club. And all of a sudden, you're like, oh, I don't think this is a club. I think this is something else. And it is something else. Before you leave, you might decide what that something else actually is. We're in the middle of a series called The Artisan's Soul. And we've been looking together at a basic narrative of what it means to be human. That we as human beings are different than every other species on the planet. There's a lot of beautiful species. Otters are awesome. I'm a huge otter fan. Killer whales, they're extraordinary. But humans are this extraordinary species that have this unique capacity to materialize the imagination. That in a very peculiar and beautiful way, human beings are almost a universe of ideas that have taken on flesh and blood. And that those ideas form an idea of us and who we become, and we call that a soul. Because we have layers of self. And one of the peculiar things about humans is, in the same way that bees create hives and ants create colonies, humans create futures. We imagine what does not exist, and if we bring together the courage and the competencies, that imagination becomes reality. We have dreams of a life we've never lived, and then some of us find the insanity to pursue that dream and make it our lives. We have an idea of a world that should exist, and some people find the courage and resolve to not surrender to what is, but to surrender to what must become. And that's a part of what we call human history. Have you ever had one of those moments where you have like 1,000 ideas running through your head and you have a hard time landing on one? I'm kind of in that space right now. I have 1,000 different ideas going through my head right now. But I know one of them is supposed to be my talk, so I'm trying to listen to that thought and idea. Because I spent the last week in Vancouver at an event called TED. That stands for Technology, Entertainment, and Design. I love TED. I mean TED is like it's a context for insanity. I mean imagination, and you know their theme is ideas worth spreading. And I love listening to people in so many different fields and so many different arenas of expertise. I mean, I have come back knowing so much more about black holes. I mean, they have changed in my life, I'm telling you. I saw a woman who lost her legs in the Boston Terrorist Act dance. I saw the future of bionics. And it was astounding. Humans are impressive as a species. I learned about bacteria's. And I was already interested in bacteria, but I learned things about bacteria that I don't want to know, that I cannot now unlearn. And yet bacteria are not nearly as terrifying as what I learned about parasites. If I told you everything I know about parasites, you would not be able to sleep tonight. And fireflies, don't even go there. You don't want to know. But I think I will tell you a little bit about parasites. There's a parasite. There's a parasite that invades animals and insects, or different parasites actually, that actually invades the insect and doesn't kill the insect. It secretes a toxin that goes into that insect's brain and controls the insect. Parasitical mind control. It's terrifying. There's a parasite that goes inside of crickets. And it doesn't kill the cricket, it controls the cricket. And it gives the cricket a death wish. The cricket, because of this parasite, cannot do what it wants to do. It must go to water. And the parasite causes the cricket to have a death wish. It dives into water. Because the parasite can only reproduce in the water, and it cannot get to the water itself, so it has to invade a cricket so it can take a cab all the way to the water. Then the cricket jumps into the water, drowns, and dies. And the parasite, I saw it, comes out of the cricket. I cannot unsee that. I told you, you didn't want to know. But what's strange to me is that I started thinking about these parasites because I've used that language of parasites before I ever knew there were actually parasites that could actually invade a person's or a thing's or an insect's brain. Because years ago, I was talking to a man in Toronto. He was an Asian engineer, brilliant, intelligent. And I was in this conversation, this larger dialogue at a university about does God exist? And he came up to me and he said, I'm an atheist. And you talk about hearing the voice of God. What does God's voice sound like? And I said, well, you're an atheist, so God's voice would sound like nothing, right? He goes, yeah, but you say you can hear the voice of God, so what does God's voice sound like? And I said, well, why are you here? He goes, what do you mean, why am I here? I said, I mean, why are you here? And he goes, well, I came for the dialogue. And no, why are you here? Why are you here talking to me? You're an atheist that doesn't believe in God. Why are you asking me as an atheist what the voice of God sounds like? It seems to be an odd question for an atheist. He goes, well, because I want to know, what does God's voice sound like to you? Do you know there's a lot of voices in your head? I have a lot of voices in my head. I have so many voices in my head, I don't know where they came from. Like some of the voices I can identify, you know, it's like my mom living inside of my brain and then my sisters, my brother, teachers that didn't like me, teachers I didn't like. There's a lot of people who decided to reside in my head and they have stayed. But there are other people, I don't know how they got there. You have voices in your head, you don't know how they got there. And some of the voices are clearly you. They're your confident you and your insignificant you and your apathetic you and your like narcissistic you. You have all these yous, but you can tell they're you. But do you ever have a voice you're going, where did that voice come from? I mean, remember when I first got tinnitus and the ringing in my head was immense, and it still is actually. And it was overwhelming and I couldn't sleep at night and I started feeling despair. And all of a sudden, I literally start seeing images in my mind of taking a gun to my head and blowing my brains out. I can tell you, I didn't fabricate that. I didn't intend it. I didn't know where it came from. It just entered my head. And I started having suicidal thoughts, and I'm like, stop it! And I was trying to silence voices in my head. Have you ever had those experiences where there's these voices in your head, and you don't even want them in your head? Thank you. Because I was feeling very alone and awkward. I mean, there's a lot of good voices in my head, too. But those, sometimes those other voices are... So anyway, back to this engineer. And I said, do you want to know what the voice of God sounds like? And he goes, well, yes. I said, well, when you're an atheist, it's a little more challenging to identify the voice of God in your head. But you know there's no God, right? And he goes, yes, I know there's no God. And you know that it's foolish to believe in God, yes. And so you don't believe in God, no. Do you have a little voice in your head that says, there is a God, there is a God, there is a God? You know that nagging little voice in your brain, you cannot figure how you got there. I said this, it's like a parasite eating away at your brain. When you know that there's no God, that the voice keeps saying, there is a God. You ever have that voice just eating away like a parasite in your brain? He goes, yes, it's like a parasite in my head. I said, that's God. I said, see, and now I know that there are parasites and insects. And is it possible that we humans were like ideas wrapped up in skin? And ideas are like, in some positive and negative sense, parasites in our heads. Sometimes we get an idea that we don't matter and it eats away at our souls. We get an idea that we can't change or life cannot be better and it eats away at our souls. Sometimes we have ideas in our heads like parasites that tell us it's not worth fighting for life. Not worth the struggle. That you'll never love again. That you'll never be loved. That you'll never find love. There are all these ideas that become like parasites inside of our brains. And what's strange is that you wouldn't think ideas would have so much power, would you? But ideas can change you forever. The moment you begin to see a better you, that idea can inspire you and change you. The moment you begin to see a different life, that life can so provoke inside of you such intensity and passion that you actually begin to live that life. And for some of you, you will be taken over by an idea, like a parasite that says you must create a better world, that you must create a different world, that you must be a part of a change that must happen, that has been way too long in coming, and you will sacrifice yourself for the power of that idea. See, as we look at the artisan soul, and we work with this basic construct that every human being is an artisan, every human being is a creative, and that this is, in fact, the most powerful reflection of the image of God in you. That you were imagined by God, and because you were imagined in the imagination of God, He so naturally gave you an imagination. And that imagination is a reflection of being created in the image and likeness of God, that you were imagined to imagine. You were created to create. And that's a part of the human dilemma, is that especially in the context of faith, no one ever told us. We would long to create. No one ever told us that we were designed to create. No one ever told us that we were born to create. In fact, so much of what we were told was that we need to stop creating and start conforming. To be good boys and girls. To line up and standardize. And stop dreaming and imagining. It's time to grow up and do your job. But there's an interesting passage of Scripture in Hebrews 11 that many of you may be familiar with, and I want you to hear these words with unfamiliar ears, to hear them afresh. In Hebrews 11, verses 1 through 6, it says that now faith is confidence in what we hope for and assurance about what we do not see. This is what the ancients were commended for. By faith, we understand that the universe was formed at God's command so that what is seen was not made out of what was visible. By faith, Abel brought God a better offering than Cain did. By faith, he was commended as righteous when God spoke well of his offering. And by faith, Abel still speaks even though he is dead. I hope my words are still speaking long after I'm dead. By faith, Enoch was taken from this life so that he did not experience death. He could not be found because God had taken him away. For before he was taken, he was commended as one who pleased God. And without faith, it is impossible to please God, because anyone who comes to him must believe that he exists and that he rewards those who earnestly seek him. I love these words because it is a transformation of a mental construct of the way we understand reality. Stay with me for a minute. Do you ever read a passage in the Scriptures and it really doesn't make any sense, but you pretend it does? You go, of course. You act like it's so obvious, of course. But it actually is saying what you shouldn't be believing. I mean, think about this for a moment. It says, faith is confidence in things hoped for. Really? You're supposed to be confident about things hoped for. That's not how confidence works. That's usually stupidity. I mean, have you ever had somebody walk in without preparing for something? No training, no discipline, no prep, and they just think they're going to be awesome because they're so talented. You watch them just crash and burn. You know, that's false confidence. That's narcissism. See, you're confident when you've prepared for something. You're confident when you've trained. You're confident when you've disciplined yourself. You're confident when you've taken on the hard work of being good at something. And that's why that 15-year-old gymnast can win that Olympic gold, because she's trained and disciplined and sacrificed her time and energy and talent to be confident in that moment to be the best in the world. See, confidence usually comes from what we build toward, not what we hope for. So he says that faith is the confidence of things hoped for. What he's telling us is that when we begin to live our lives in relationship with God, something changes in the way we see reality, in the way we engage as a human being. Because when you hope for something, it's in the future. When you prepare for something, it's in the past. Confidence is usually built on what we know and where we've been. It's not usually built on what we don't know and where we've never gone. And yet he says we have to have confidence in what we hope for. He's telling us that the anchor of our confidence needs to no longer be thrown in the past, but now be thrown into the future. Is that kind of insane? You should be confident in the future, which is the one thing that you cannot know. But when you enter into relationship with God, when you connect to this transcendent being, you now are a citizen of the future, even though you're a resident of the present. And you can have confidence in what you hope for. And by the way, hope is one of those peculiar things that only exists in the future. You cannot hope for something in the past. Like, I hope you're not here thinking, I hope I do better in high school. You're not going to do better in high school. I hope you're not looking back going, wow, you know, when I was 15, she didn't say yes, but I'm hoping that one day she'll say yes. She said no when you were 15, and that no stands for all time. See, you can't hope. You weighed less last year. I mean, I know that's a lot of our, like, health plans. I hope I will do better in the past. You cannot hope for something to change yesterday. You can only hope for something to change tomorrow. You can only hope in the future, which is the one elusive space that only exists in the invisible and can only be connected through the imagination, through ideas and dreams and visions and hopes. You ever hoped you could meet the right guy? Or the right girl? You ever come to, like, a place like Mosaic to meet God? Right? Because you hope that God became man and or at least inhabits a man. I know how it works, and you're hoping that searching for God will run you into her. Seating is strategic here. And you can have hope. I mean, there's some of you, you're single. Now, most women are more honest. They'll say, yeah, I hope I get married. I hope that I meet, like, the right guy, the man of my dreams. Most guys are more dishonest. Single for life. Single for life. Then you feel betrayed every time all your friends get married. I thought we were in this together, man. Like, we're 46. We're gonna die single. You see, when you're saying, I just hope I can meet the man of my dreams, and you're single, that's a future hope. If you're saying that and you're married, that's a problem. Right? And that's why so many times people are discouraged when they get married, because they hope that marriage will end their loneliness. They hope that marriage will end their sense of despair. They hope that marriage will end their sense of incompleteness. And when they're married, it no longer gives them that hope, because hope is always rooted in the future, not in the past. That's regret, not in the present. See, when you enter into this strange space of the artisan, you have to eventually move from imagination to image. See, it begins with imagination, but it's confidence in things hoped for and an assurance of things not seen. Now, who has assurance in things not seen? By the way, that's another one of those lines that we pretend it makes sense. No, we actually have assurance in things seen. I know it's there. I have this job. I have this car. I have this life, this place to live, this clothes. I have assurance in these things. I have this talent, this ability, these skills, these competencies. There's nothing more unnerving than having assurances about unseen things. Have you ever depended on other people who just didn't come through? Have you ever put your trust in someone and thought they would do what they said, but they didn't do what they said? Have you ever had friends that never do what they say? And so you don't do what you say because you're sure they're not going to do what they've said, and then they surprise you and do what they said, and then you didn't do what you said, and you're like, I didn't do what I said because I didn't think you'd do what you said, and now I'm confused. Because one of the most difficult things in the world is to actually have assurance in things not seen. That job opportunity that's just around the corner, that break that's just waiting to happen, that relationship that soon is going to come into your life, all those things that you have so little control over, it's so hard to have assurance there.
But what's beautiful is the scriptures tell us that this is what the ancients were commended for. You see, the moment you enter into a relationship with God, it expands the universe of your imagination. See, when you say there is no God, the only spectrum your imagination can travel is the material world. But the moment you believe in God, it actually expands the boundaries of your imagination. I mean, even if there wasn't a God, it's a great idea to believe in God because it actually expands your capacity to dream and imagine and create. Is it possible that's because we're actually created by a creator? And that our imagination expands into an ever-expanding universe of possibilities when we're connected to the God who created the ever-expanding universe. I remember when I was in college, I took classes in art. And there's one particular art class where I loved the teacher. She was so eccentric. She was an artist who was kind of like a visiting professor. And we were graded and tested on our works of art, which was different than getting tests where you filled in blanks or you had multiple choice or you had to write essays. You had to paint. You had to design. You had to create. And it was incredibly unnerving because you can memorize data and look as intelligent as everyone else, but when you create, it leaves you naked. It exposes what you have to bring to the process. And she would always highlight different works of art from different students that were commendable or extraordinary or beautiful, and so my pieces were not selected. But I still enjoyed the class, and then one day, I was actually in shock. I decided I loved pastels and I loved charcoals because they gave me a lot of room for error. And pen and ink were just my enemies. And one day she held up my painting and began to have a conversation with the class about my work. She called me Raphael because that was the name of her lover. And it was my middle name, and she goes, "Ah, Raphael." And it made me nervous. And she held up my painting and she said, "You're a musician, aren't you?" And I said, "Well, yes, I used to try to be a musician." And you see, I had painted a painting of a guitar. It was the one thing of value I owned. Everything I had could fit into a grocery bag. And then I had a guitar. And no matter where I went or what I did, I had my clothes in that grocery bag and then I had the guitar. I would leave clothes behind, shoes behind, books behind, people behind, but I would never leave that guitar behind. And when I traveled across the country and people say, "I don't have enough room for your luggage," I go, "Don't worry, I don't have any luggage, I just have a guitar." And when I translated that guitar onto a canvas, I didn't realize what had happened. See, when she saw that painting, she says, "I know you're a musician because this is the first work of art that you actually could see what you were painting." And she did not mean seeing with my eyes. Somehow she knew that I translated onto that canvas my emotional connection to this instrument. This organic relationship that I had with this piece of wood that I held sometimes 1 or 2 hours a day, sometimes 5 or 6 hours a day, and worked for years and years to write and create. And there is this palatable relationship with the sound of those notes going into the depth of my soul, and it translated on the sheet of canvas. And I began to realize that we as artists can only materialize that which changes us, that transforms us, that we turn from imagination to image that which has turned us from imagination to image. Because you are both a work of art and an artist at work. And there's something that you're supposed to imagine and turn into image. Have you ever talked to people who just have 1,000 ideas but they never do anything? People, "Oh, I got an idea." And at first you're excited when you first meet them. "Wow, he has such great ideas. She has so many ideas," but they never do anything. They're all talk. And I hope that's not you. I'm not talking about you, even if you think I'm talking about you. If you're offended, it might be you. Because you think, "Oh, I have so many ideas." Have you ever been mad because someone stole your idea? Mm-hmm. right? Times people say, Irwin, don't share your ideas because someone's going to steal them. Because we live in a world where people steal ideas because great ideas are a rare commodity. But have you ever noticed that great ideas are rarely stolen by people who live courageously? Because they actually, what they do is they actualize those ideas. They live out those ideas. They materialize those ideas. See, sometimes we have great ideas, but we don't have the great courage to live them out. And so someone else is like vacant of ideas, and they hear a great idea, but they are not vacant of courage and resolve. So they took your great idea and they made it a reality. They took your imagination and turned it into image, and it made you so mad because you were going to do that. You're going to get to it one day. And they didn't do it as well as you would have done it, right? Yeah, that's not really what I was thinking. It's not as good as what I saw. You know why? Because your idea is perfect, but the image is always imperfect. See, that's the great risk of the creative process, is to take something out of your imagination and to bring it into reality, and that filter is brutal. It is filled with imperfection. It is filled with imprecision. It is filled with failure. It is filled with dents and scratches. And you still have to find the courage to create. And there's something in your head that the world needs. Have you ever thought maybe like every idea has been done? I mean, there are people in history that thought, oh, every great idea, it's been already like created. I mean, after the iPhone, what's left? And right, the iPad, really, a large phone where you can't talk to people, you know, and it's just awkward. And you think, well, maybe all the great ideas have been created. I mean, I'm in shock. There are only like 12 notes. I mean, wouldn't you think we would have already exhausted all the music that's out there? 12 notes, that's all we've got. We work with 12 notes and angst, and we create all of this music. Generations and generations, and yet from Mozart to Chopin to the Beatles, to the Stones, to Depeche Mode, to Coldplay, to Radiohead, to the Killers. It just seems like we can't exhaust all the endless possibilities of what these notes can create when it comes to sound and texture and emotion. 12 notes. And how many ways can we actually sing I Love You? And yet we find one more way to sing it. And we also say, I used to love you, but now you're a jerk, and so I never really loved you. And we do that over and over and over again, and we call that country music. And we never get tired of it because we find one more way of doing it. You think about like colors. Wouldn't you think we would run out of colors? I mean, when I was growing up, the Crayola box had like 3 colors. I mean, I know I'm older than you guys. And a lot of you guys have been like Crayola pampered, but I had like blue, yellow, and red. And then the 5-pack gave us black and white with the blue, yellow, and red. We lived for the 5-pack. Some of you, you wouldn't even slow down if you saw an 8-pack of Crayolas or a 16-pack. I bet you a lot of you started with the 32-pack, didn't you? Come on, admit it, you started. That's how you started. You were 5 years old eating a 32-pack. We couldn't afford to eat our 5-pack. Because we were walking 20 miles in the snow in El Salvador to school with our 5-pack of Crayolas. We knew, I can't eat this. This is going to last me the whole week. 32-packs. Some of you, and I want confessions. Some of you, your parents, because they indulged you, they gave you the 64-pack. I want to know, how many of you here had a 64-pack? Look around. Look at these people. Look how smug they are. And then there's some of you, gluttony, indulgence, supersize it. Some of you, you had the 128-pack, didn't you? Come on, don't lie to us. Okay, who here? Who here? Your mom gave you the 128-pack. Raise your hand. I want to see you there. Oh, yeah, there you are. I know. Don't raise it high. It's shameful. All right? I mean, it's like, I'm convinced this is the core of our economic dilemma. Because when you have like a 5-pack or a 3-pack, you know. Man, I got to create. I don't have a lot. You got that 128 pack. You're like, oh, look, the whole world is mine. I don't have to create it. All the colors have been created. I remember when I opened that first pack that had blue, green, and green, blue. I'm putting them side by side. Look, two different forms of blue, green, green, blue. This is awesome. Mixing colors. You'd think we'd run out of potential colors. Have you actually tried now to pick out white for your walls? You could spend a month and you would still not run out of whites. I mean, how many whites can be created? And they're in tones, like blue whites and pink whites and brown whites and egg whites. It just goes on and on and on. And you see, the dilemma sometimes is when you have too much, you stop creating, you just start consuming. And sometimes the danger is to believe that everything has already been created or just waiting for someone else to create what needs to be created. And you don't realize that you were created to create. You don't realize you were imagined to imagine. You don't realize that you're supposed to take your imagination and translate it into image, that there's something the world needs from you that no one else in the world can bring. I love this place in Genesis chapter 4 that reminds us that there is a day when there wasn't and a day when there was. See, there's a day when there wasn't, and there's a day, then a day where there was, where someone imagined something and then created the image. In Genesis chapter 4, verses 20 through 22, three verses, it says, Adah gave birth to Jabal, not a popular name. And Jabal was the father of those who lived in tents and raised livestock. I love this. Before Jabal, no one ever lived in a tent, and no one ever had livestock. And maybe before Jabal, no one even thought of it. Before Jabal, maybe no one even imagined it. They wandered through the prairies, and every day they had to get up and go hunting. And then it was raining, they would get soaking wet, and they would just keep walking through the rain, or maybe just stop and allow the rain to soak them. Or sometimes they would be near a cave, and they would run into the cave and realize it was already occupied by a lion. And the lion may have thought rain was the source of all meat. Thank you. And one day, Jabal just thought, I think I'm smart enough to get out of the rain. What about if I take a cave and I make a mobile cave? And instead of going after the animals, maybe I can get the animals to come after me. Maybe I could lay some food out and move these animals, and I could build a fence. A fence is a new concept, so no one knew what that meant, but he knew what it meant. And I could create a wall in the middle of the prairie, in the middle of this large mass of land. I'll just create this fence, and I'll feed the animals, and they'll come here, and they'll become my livestock. Instead of hunting, I'll just raise them and then cook them. And then I'll take the leather from their hide and I'll sew them together and I'll make this cave that I can take with me everywhere I go. Can you imagine how Jabal's stock went up? I mean, he was the first architect. He was the first designer in that sense. He was the one who imagined something that did not exist, tents and livestock, and he changed the course of human history. And when he first started bringing the animals in, I imagine everybody's like, wait a minute, that's not right. There's got to be something fundamentally wrong with us. And when he built the first tent, I imagine everybody's like mocking him. What are you doing? I'm building a tent, which would have meant nothing. And he could have said, I'm building a mobile cave. And you won't understand why it matters until it rains. And then when it starts raining, see this guy, when it was sunny, was probably not that good looking. But the moment it started raining, he started looking more attractive with every drop. Can you imagine how easy it would be to get a date? It's wet out there. I have a tent. Would you like to come and join me in my tent? We'll read Chaucer and barbecue. It'd be so easy. And then he had a brother named Jubal. And Jubal wasn't an architect and a designer of this kind, but he was a creative as well. His brother's name was Jubal and Jabal. Bad idea. And he was the father of all who played stringed instruments and pipes. So before Jubal, there were no string instruments or pipes. Isn't that crazy? So Jabal is out there. Man, I wish his parents had written a parenting book on how to awaken your creative child. Because here's Jabal making tents and livestock, and his parents are probably like, yeah, he was always a problem. And then you have Jubal going, I'm not really into tents and livestock. And maybe one day he's like wandering around and he sees this cat running across the field when the bison come roaming and, and the cat's laying out there like flat, guts spilling everywhere. And Jubal was, you know, a little neurotic, eccentric, and he's like, look at that. It's cat gut. Wonder what it feels like. Ooh, it's warm. Look at this gut. And you just imagine how everyone else was probably looking at him with condescension. He's playing with cat gut. Yeah, but look. If you take the cat gut and you work with it just right and you get the tension right, boom, you get like cat gut sound. And I think I can take enough of these. Let's start with three and see if I can create different textures and tensions. And I think boom, 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 the sounds will change. But I need to find a way to project this more powerfully. And you notice that in the caves, there's this resonance and reverberation. And so he hollowed out a piece of wood. And he placed the strings across and boom, 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 and started playing his upright bass. And Jabal, he had all the girls when it was raining. But Jubal just started playing his bass, singing in the rain. And all of a sudden, he was the most popular guy because he could take sounds and through those sounds translate human emotion and tell the human story through strings. But before Jubal, there were no strings. Before Jubal, the soul longed to sing and find a rest for its melody and had no place to go. But it wasn't enough for him. He created the pipes as well. Do you know what pipes are? Pipes are the instrument that capture the sound of the wind. That's what pipes are. What happened in Jubal one day when he heard the wind traveling through the woods and he heard the wind pierce through an old rotted tree whose branches were hollowed out, and he heard the sound of the wind singing. Wonder if he was captured when the wind started blowing through the bamboo. He said, I think the wind has a song he wants to give to us. He took the pieces of bamboo and the hollowed out pieces of branches, and he captured the sounds and the voice of the wind, and he gave it to the world as a gift. Before Jubal, the wind was silent and could not speak to us. But after Jubal, we learn to speak with the wind, to write songs that told the human story. Jabal and Jubal. And then there was another guy named Tubal-Cain, another unpopular name. And it says, Tubal-Cain, it was he who forged all kinds of tools out of bronze and iron. And can you imagine people trying to dig a line in the dirt to plant the seed and not be able to go deep enough? I have to work endless hours to accomplish so little. And Tubal-Cain decided to take bronze and iron and forge it with fire and to create instruments that match what he saw in nature. And so perhaps he saw the tusk of an elephant and he created a tusk, and it was called a hoe or a shovel. Maybe he saw someone he loved ripped to shreds by the claw of a lion, and he was defenseless to help. And so he forged bronze and iron to create a spear, to create a human claw, not given to us through our biology, but through our imagination. But before him, there were no tools made of bronze or iron. What is your before and after? What will define your life that you imagined and turned into image? What will it be that you create with your life that you can look back and say, yes, this is why I was created. This is what I was made for. I can tell you, sometimes you don't know. Sometimes you don't even realize you're in the middle of it. Sometimes you're just haunted by an idea like a parasite in your brain. I can tell you 20 years ago when we began this journey to create Mosaic, we had no idea where we were going or what it was going to be like, and we didn't realize how much resistance we would have. I mean, all I was trying to do is create a space where there was an intersection of spirituality and creativity, a place where Jesus could awaken humanity so that we could be our most creative selves. I didn't know how controversial that would be. I didn't know how many people would get mad the first time we had dancers on the stage. I just didn't know. It was such a violent act to bring ballet and hip-hop to a Sunday gathering. I can tell you, I didn't know how traumatizing it would be to people when I brought painters and we started sculpting in the auditorium. Yes, the metalworking was a bad idea with all the sparks and the small children, but creativity demands risk and often failure. I didn't know that when I was editing films and interweaving them into my talks early on, that one, they would create copyright laws that would stop us, but two, that it would create so much antagonism from people saying, you're bringing the world into the church. And I said, no, I think I'm taking the church into the world. There's something wrong. See, when I became a follower of Christ, I didn't know anything about Christianity. I was sort of like a blank slate, and I thought that the movement of Jesus looked a lot like Jesus. See, because when I came to Jesus, what he did in me is he awakened my creative self. What happened when I came to Jesus is he seemed to erase all the lines that were placed there by fear and doubt and guilt and shame, all the lines that told me I needed to conform and be standardized, and telling you Jesus just blew them all away and began to awaken my imagination and unleash my creativity. I thought that's what the church would be like. I didn't know. It wasn't like that. And when I started writing books and laying out this view of what it means to be human, it didn't go well. Man, I didn't know Christians could be so mean. I didn't know there was so much antagonism and even violence in the name of Jesus. And when I was going to church, I didn't know what to do because here I am now, a follower of Christ, and for some odd reason, given the gifts to speak, and I didn't want to. It seemed like every time I opened my mouth, someone got mad. Someone felt angry, and I kept thinking, I didn't come to pick a fight with the people of Jesus. See, I didn't know that the church was the last bastion of protection of the past rather than the instrument of creating the future. I didn't know the church was so afraid to create, so afraid to imagine, so afraid to be who God created us to be. And I got to tell you, I think there's some of you here who are like me. I started going to church and I was suffocating. I was dying. I couldn't breathe. There wasn't enough air in the room because it seemed like the church just sucked the air out of the room. And there's some of you who ran away from God because your soul was dying. And you ran away from church because you were suffocating to death. And inside of you, there's always been this turmoil because you didn't want to run from God, and you somehow knew that Jesus had something that mattered, but you didn't want to stay in this place where your soul was being sucked dead. And we got to stop pretending that it's been okay. We have to stop pretending that the church has been all right. We got to tell the truth. And even though I have to believe it was well-intended, well-meaning, good-hearted people, but they were afraid of our freedom. They were afraid of what you or I might do if we truly became our most powerful selves. They were afraid of what would happen if you began to imagine, if you somehow found out the secret that you were created to create, that you were imagined to imagine, that you are a work of art and an artist at work. They were terrified that you would think that like bees create hives and ants create colonies, that you create futures. And so the language came out there that no, this is what God does. And so we kept looking at the heavens saying, God, why aren't you doing anything? And he keeps looking at us saying, I did something. It's you. But what I want to know is, why won't you take what I've put into your imagination and turn it into image? Because a dream is a nightmare left unlived. And then it made sense. It made sense what happened to Elijah back in 1 Kings 18. It says in verse 41, and Elijah said to Ahab, who was the king, go eat and drink, for there is the sound of a heavy rain. So Ahab went off to eat and drink, but Elijah climbed to the top of Carmel, bent down to the ground and put his face between his knees. Go out and look toward the sea. He told his servant, and he went up and looked, and there was nothing there. He said, seven times Elijah said, go back. And the seventh time the servant reported, a cloud as small as a man's hand, the size of a fist, is rising from the sea. So Elijah said, go and tell Ahab, hitch up your chariot and go down before the rain stops you. Meanwhile, the sky grew black with clouds, the wind rose, a heavy rain started falling, and Ahab rode off to Jezreel. The power of the Lord came on Elijah, and tucking his cloak into his belt, he ran ahead of Ahab all the way to Jezreel. There was three and a half years of drought. 3.5 years where they had not heard the sound of a raindrop hitting the earth. 3.5 years where they had not felt the cool wind blowing while the clouds were forming in the sky. 3.5 years where they had not heard the sound of thunder or seen the power of lightning. 3.5 years of drought in a desert. And Elijah says to Ahab, I hear the sound of a heavy rain. I always would translate that whenever I'd read that to say what Elijah was saying was, I'm about to pray and rain is coming. Or I believe rain is coming. But now I believe it exactly the way he said it. I hear the sound of heavy rain. See, I'm convinced that we humans were designed to be citizens of the future and residents of the present. And when we enter a relationship with the living God, we actually begin to be the instruments through which he ushers in the future into the present. And you live in this strange, powerful, maddening space where you hear what the world cannot hear, and you see what the world cannot see, and you know what the world cannot know, because it is happening first in the universe inside of you. Elijah says, I hear the sound of a heavy rain. And then he sends a servant. Well, he goes to Carmel and he sits down and he waits. And he sends a servant to go to the seashore, and he sends him once and he comes back and he says nothing. That must be hard to come back to tell your friend there's nothing there. And he sends you back a second time. And a third time, and you come back and you say nothing. He sends you back a fourth and a fifth time, and you come back and you say there's just nothing there. That sixth time, that must be brutal. I think on the sixth time, I would want to come back and say, there could be something there. All I see is blue sky, but I'm not an expert on this. And maybe there's something there. Or maybe if you're Elijah, after the sixth time, you just put your head down and say, I thought I heard the sound of heavy rain. I must have been wrong. It must have been something else. I think a lot of us live in between the sixth and the seventh note, between the sixth and the seventh stroke, between the sixth and the seventh act. And we quit too soon, not believing that God has whispered into our souls an idea that has to come to life. That God has whispered a dream that must become reality. That God has shown us a future that we must create. And on that seventh time, he went back and he didn't see much. He came back, and this is the best he could do. I saw a cloud the size of a fist. I saw just a cloud the size of a fist rising over the horizon. And I'm sure for him, it was just a glimmer of possibility and hope for Elijah. But Elijah, that's all he needed. He said, go tell Ahab, the storm is coming. The storm is coming. Because the rain I could hear will now be heard by everyone. I can tell you, when I wrote this book, The Artisan Soul, it surprised me. 6 years of silence. Man, I was so tired of writing books and having people tell me I was a heretic and just tearing us to shreds. And I was tired of pulling spears out of my chest and knives out of my back. And it's better to go silent. You make fewer enemies. And I just feel like God has said to me, Erwin, you can just hide in your imagination, or you can find the courage to turn your imagination into humanity's future. I'm going to leave it up to you. And when I wrote it, I thought maybe 1,000 years from now, we'll see human beings differently. And then later I thought, no, in 500 years, our whole view of what it means to be human will change. And then I started getting more confidence, and I thought, no, in 100 years, the church will be different. But something has driven me to the brink of madness. And my wife said to me today, stop telling people you're going mad. But there's a madness settling in. I think that we are at a moment in history where everything is going to change. I am absolutely convinced that in our lifetime, the church will relent from becoming the place where people are called to conform and the place where people are called to create. I am absolutely convinced that in our lifetime, the narrative of who God is, from warden to prison guard, is going to change from creator and artisan God. I'm absolutely convinced that people will know that Jesus is at the epicenter of human creativity and profound spirituality. And I'm absolutely convinced that we are at the edge, at the front of this new anthropology, this revolution of creativity. And it's us together who are going to take the scriptures back from this manuscript of conformity to a manifesto of creativity. I am absolutely convinced, and you can tell me on my deathbed when I take my last breath that I was wrong. But I'm going to say to you, I'm going to declare before you that I'm convinced that the revolution has begun and it's going to change the course of human history, and that Jesus will no longer be the tail that we keep wagging behind the change the world needs, because we're so afraid of the future and lost in the past, that we are going to be the pioneers and the point. We're going to be the citizens of the future that come back to visit the present, to bring the rest of humanity with us. I hear the sound of a heavy rain. And I want to know, what do you hear? How long will it take you? Will you believe when the rain has drenched the soil of the earth and you are standing wet and say, oh, I see it now? Will you believe when you finally see the raindrops falling on the leaves of a tree and pressing against the skin of your face? Will you believe when you feel the cold breeze coming, or when you see the clouds forming over the skies? Or will you be like the ancient ones who had confidence in what they hope for and assurance in what is not seen? Will you be with me, the ones who hear the heavy rain? This is what it means to embrace your artisan soul. Father, I just don't want to do church. I want to be church. I want to be this movement that your son Jesus died for 2,000 years ago. I want to live the life that you experienced, Jesus, when you rose from the dead. I don't want anything less. I want us to be a place and a people that frees humanity, that believes in its value and beauty, that unlocks the human spirit, that unleashes each person to create a world that is more beautiful and more good and more true. I want us to be a people of wonder. May our tools be our faith and our hope and our love. And God, I want to pray for anyone who's here tonight that ran from you because they were suffocating, that walked away from the church because they couldn't breathe anymore, but they so want to find you. Their souls are longing for you, Jesus. They've just been afraid. I pray that tonight they would find that freedom and that safety in you. They would trust their hearts and lives and souls to you. They would trust you with their dreams and their passions. May you meet them here tonight. Just with everyone's head bowed and your eyes closed. You know, if you're here tonight and you just know that what you need is Jesus, and for you, maybe like your heart is pounding against your chest and you feel like right now you're going crazy because you're having the thought, I need Jesus. I need to give my life to God. He's what I'm searching for. If you're here tonight and you're ready, say, I know Jesus died for me and rose from the dead, and I want to give him my life and trust him with my future. I want him to awaken everything inside of me that he put in me to be a gift to the world. If you're here tonight, you'd say, I choose Jesus tonight. I just want you to do the most difficult thing right now, and I want you to stand and just say, tonight, I give my life to Jesus. I'm just going to wait for you if there's anyone here tonight. It's beautiful. Anyone else? Just stand. Awesome. Right now, just stand. I can make this easier. I don't want to make it easier. Jesus stepped into human history and was crucified for you. He didn't make it easier on himself. So I just want you to stand right now. It's wonderful. Anywhere else? Anyone else? Right now, just stand. Wherever you are, just stand. It's good. Someone came up to Lawrence and said, last week I knew I should have stood. I knew I should have stood, but I didn't stand. So he came at 6 o'clock and he stood. Don't put off a week. You're going to lose a week. Right now, just stand and say, this is my moment. I'm a work of art, and I want Jesus to make me a masterpiece. And I want to be an artist at work. I want God to use me to do something beautiful in the world. That's awesome. It's beautiful. Anyone else? We want to be patient. We want to wait for you. It's beautiful. All right, I'm going to pray. Anyone else? Okay, now before I pray, you may be here and you're like, you've made a private decision, but you've never made it public and you need to be baptized. You're like, man, I got to go public. I got to be all in. And if that's you, I just want you to stand up right now, if that's you. Awesome. Anyone else? All right, that's good. Anyone else right now? This is your moment. This is for you. Right now, just stand and be Jesus. I want to be the canvas. I just want you to paint on me. Make me beautiful. Make me holy, God. Right now, someone else. All right, it's awesome. Anyone else? Father, I want to pray for these and the ones that are still going to stand even when I'm praying and the ones that should have stood. I want to pray, God, for everyone right now who's standing, that right now they would just receive your love, that they would just tell you, God, I need you. Just tell God, I need you. Say, God, I give myself to you. Say, Jesus, I believe you died for me, that you rose from the dead. So I choose to follow you. I belong to you. I receive your forgiveness. I receive your love. I receive your life in me. I pray in Jesus' name. Father, I pray for those that prayed words like this tonight, that they would know that everything changed tonight. That in this moment, they have translated from a life outside of you to a life that will always be within you. I pray that right now they would know forgiveness and acceptance and love and grace. This is my prayer in Jesus' name.
Thank you so much for joining us on the Mosaic Podcast. I want to encourage you to take the message you just received and allow it to go deeply into your soul. Let Jesus do the deep work that only He can do. A special thank you to everyone who gives to Mosaic. Your sacrifice makes this podcast possible and creates life change all over the world. You can be a part of spreading this message around the world by going to mosaic.org/give. You can also subscribe, rate, and share this podcast with your friends and family. Thanks again for listening. God bless you.